Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today. Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. Oh, this one is going to be so good today because we've got something really different for you. I am joined today by Amy Jeffs, who is an art historian with a PhD from Cambridge, specialising in the Middle Ages. She's researched things like medieval manuscripts, pilgrim souvenirs, medieval badges at institutions like the British Museum. But she's also an artist herself, and she's come up with a fantastic idea for blending it all together for a medieval history book. So it's Storyland retells the history of Britain using our oldest myths and legends. Amy, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be really interesting. Let's just dive right in. When did you have the light bulb moment for this and how did it come about? It's so simple yet brilliant, the idea of giving a history of Britain but through what everybody used to believe, basically.
Well, it was, I suppose there were two moments. The first one was 5 a.m. November the 18th, no, 14th, 2018, I emailed a printmaker called Chris Pig saying that I really wanted professional help with my lino cut. I'd started doing it, but I knew there was this whole world of professional conventions out there. I wanted to learn it properly. And I emailed him. He has a studio in Frome where I live. And he emailed back 10 minutes later saying he found the right place. And I started learning lino cut and producing a series of illustrations of Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, which is an origin myth of Britain written in the 12th century. And it was one of the focus texts of my PhD. So there was that. And then there was about a year later, I took my prints to see Dan Jones, the historian.
Yep.
And he said, and we were talking about how to storyboard them. And he said, have you thought about doing it chronologically? And at that moment, it was like, that's it. That's it.
He's Start. So annoying with stuff like that. I don't know how he just comes up with ideas like without any effort whatsoever.
I think it's interesting what makes, I mean, of course, chronologically, you know, I'd been ordering it according to Britain's geography. I'd been finding different angles. And actually, so often with storytelling, the simplest answer is the best one. And I think that was definitely the case with Storyland. And then I could see that we could start just before the flood, the great flood, and we could travel all the way up to the Norman conquest and tell a history of Britain as though we were standing with a medieval Briton around about, I don't know, 1500, and saying to him or her, tell me the history of this land. How did the people come to colonize it? How did the dominant societies that occupy medieval Britain get here? And that's what the story we might have been told.
It's brilliant. As soon as the publisher sent me, because this has been slightly delayed because of COVID, hasn't it? And as soon as the publisher sent me the thing, I was like, yes, yes, we so want her. We so want her. And then they were like, oh, it's going to be a little bit of a delay. And I was like, please don't forget. Please don't forget. Such a good idea. So to do it, did it involve going back and gleaning literally the oldest source material you could find?
Well, it's such a difficult question. A lot of people ask about what's the earliest stories you've got in there? And of course, with medieval manuscripts, when something's written down isn't necessarily when it was composed. Sometimes you don't know. It might have existed in earlier manuscripts or as an oral tradition for centuries before it's written down. And so some of the later texts that I draw from, like the Scotic Chronicon, the Chronicle of the Scots by Walter Bower, that's actually early 15th century, but it draws on Irish myths that are incredibly early, you know, possibly much earlier than I think some of them, you know, intimations of these myths survive in 11th century manuscripts and are probably drawing on an oral tradition that's much older. And so, you know, it's very, I might be drawing from later manuscripts that refer to very, very early stories. There might be quite early stories that don't appear again. You know, it's a difficult thing to actually trace the chronology of the sources.
It must be so. In a way, I guess you can be a little bit, not cavalier, but a little bit easygoing with it as well, because you are going to find contradictory myths and stories, aren't you? And you could just pick the best one.
Yes, absolutely. And the great thing is that anyone who's read medieval histories or chronicles will know they are pretty unselfconsciously biased, and they will sort of shape the material according to the needs of, say, the patron that's paying for them to write this history, or the institution that they're part of. So, for instance, you know, Matthew Paris, a great medieval historian at St. Albans Abbey, he will happily twist things to make St. Albans look good. And so in writing this history, I suppose my interest was in telling a story that would feel relevant to a modern audience. And so while I pick and choose things that really stuck out to me as telling a coherent story of the political history of Britain, but with marvelous elements and with amazing characters. And I was particularly interested in animals and monsters and women. And so whereas the medieval sources might put the camera on the shoulder of a king, yeah, in terms of their narrative perspective, I might put the camera on the shoulder of a dog. You know, so I think I've tried to be true to the sources and honor them at the same time as telling an interesting story.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So you've already mentioned flooding. Tell us about some of Britain's oldest myths and legends. So they're tied in with the creation, aren't they, and Noah's flood, and they involve giants, is that right?
Yes, well, that particular story is the opening story in the book. Each narrative is followed by a commentary, so there's a kind of fiction element followed by a placing in the context of where that myth originated or where it survives and how it might have been relevant. So there's just this very enigmatic line in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, where he says that, well, the character of Merlin says that he's heard of a stone monument. The stone monument will become Stonehenge. It stands on a mountain, which happens to be mythic, in Ireland called Killerhouse. And he says it was brought there from remotest Africa by giants before the flood. And it's just that one line. It's not elaborated upon, but that sounds like a story to me. I mean, why? You know, what are these African giants doing traveling to Ireland with some really big stones? He says that the stones have healing virtues. That's another detail he gives. And so the first chapter is an imagining of that episode, of why these giants decide to make a journey across the Atlantic. Well, not across the Atlantic, along, sort of out of the Mediterranean and up to an island in the Western Ocean and erect these stones. That's before the flood. So, you know, that's the kind of the earliest moment in the chronology of the stories.
That's brilliant. Some people probably know that one of the oldest names for sort of Britain is Albion, isn't it? Going way, way back.
Yeah.
Why? Where does that come from?
So no one really knows. Yeah. Where the name Albion comes from. But the medieval, this particular medieval author of a text called the Grand Géant, or there was a Latin version as well, makes up a story that is totally brilliant about 30 Syrian sisters who are banished from their father's court. Their father is a great king, and they plot to kill him and all their husbands so that they can take the throne and rule in his stead. And
he banishes them.
he banishes them in a rudderless boat. They get caught up in a storm and they land on the shores of an uninhabited island. And the eldest sister happens to be called Albina, and she's the most ambitious anyway. And so she sort of picks up the stones on the beach and says, right, this is our land, and it's going to be called Albion. And they're just such brilliant characters. In the medieval text, they're not to be trusted in the medieval text. You know, they're not necessarily goodies. What happens later kind of demonstrates that, but I don't want to give the game away completely. But from a modern standpoint, they're brilliant. They're heroes. I think they're absolutely fantastic characters. We only know the name of one, Albina, but they learn to live off the land. You know, in the medieval text, it says how they build snares from sticks and learn to fish. And they basically are like the Raymeers and Bear Grylls of very, very, very ancient Britain, pre-Britain. And they are so successful in their foraging and hunting that they become very fat. And what happens next is too salacious for the words. So that's a great origin myth for Albion.
There's an element as well. How funny is it for all the white supremacists out there that it's all to do with Middle Eastern women as well?
Yes, exactly.
It's wonderful. That in your tiny little brains.
Yeah. Oh, and it's a joy to celebrate these stories and to and to see them through a modern lens as well, because you can't get away from those themes, and the fact that you know, Britain is founded by, you know, subsequently Britain's founded by Trojans, and Ireland and therefore Scotland by a Greek man and an Egyptian queen. So, you know, this is a there was a strong sense, I think, in the Middle Ages and for people living in Britain, that they were on the edge of the world, that they weren't an important in an important position geographically. Yeah. The center of the world was Jerusalem, and the places with really lofty histories were in the Middle East, on the foothills of paradise. So that definitely crops up.
Definitely. Let's go outside my M25 bubble, because you, mm-hmm. one thing you've done really well is get all of Britain involved in this. I was really interested by how the Severn and the Humber got their names.
Yes, that is a very sad story. And I mean, the first idea is that when the founder of Britain, who's a Trojan called Brutus, dies, he divides his territory, or just before he dies, he divides his territory between his three sons, Locrin, Camber, and Albanac. And those territories are called Lurgria, Cambria, and Albany, and they will become England, Wales, and Scotland in the future. Those are the territories. And so Locrin's ruling the territory that will become England, and the Huns invade in the north. They invade Albany, and they're led by a man called Humber. And this is at the beginning of the story of the naming of the Severn. Locrin goes up to help out his brother, and they meet the Huns on the edge of this great estuary, and drive them into the water, and King Humber sinks beneath the waves in all his mail and armor, and is never seen again. And that's how the river gets its name.
Brilliant. One that you've also mentioned as well, that you didn't necessarily do it through the lens of the most obvious people like kings and things like that, mm-hmm. and that you've tried to get women involved in this.
Of course, yes.
How does Conwenna save Britain?
I love Conwenna. My grandmother thinks she's irritating, which is funny.
Oh, really?
I think she's great. So Conwenna is the mother of two warring sons, Belinus and Brennius. And Belinus might be a euhemerization, a mortal version of a Celtic god called Belenus, who was a bit like the god Apollo, a sort of sun god. This is also in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain. And Brennius is jealous of him because he's king of all Britain and he wants a part of it. And so there's been years and years of wars, and there seemed to be a period of peace when Brennius has gone to Gaul, but then he comes back with a massive army and meets his brother on a great battlefield. And I think at this point, their elderly mother has absolutely had enough. And mm-hmm. she pushes her way through the army right out into the middle of the battlefield. And she runs up to Brennius, who's the one that's causing all the trouble, flings her arms around his neck, kisses all over his face, and then does the most unspeakable thing for a queen, and steps backward and rips open her dress, revealing her aged breasts, and says, "For heaven's sake, think of these breasts that soothed you when you were a child. Think of this body that suffered to bear you. Think of all the worry I wasted on you. If you're just going to continue this war with your brother, you have no just cause. For heaven's sake."
Yeah, I love it. Can you imagine, like, your mom comes and yeah. you and turns out on the battlefield and just says, "Behave, enough."
Yeah, and it's just there's an illustration of it in a medieval manuscript in Clare College, Cambridge, and it's just a kind of marginal pen drawing of this moment, and the soldiers really are just kind of standing there blinking, like, what do we do now?
Well, how dare a naked old lady on the battlefield protest this?
Yeah, and that's a great one, because I think one of the it's sometimes there's a tendency to see these stories too heavily as folklore, and actually they were produced by quite bookish people, yeah. the stories that I'm retelling, and especially the Conwenna episode is very reminiscent of a moment in the Iliad, when Hecuba, the queen of Troy, bears her breasts to Hector to convince him not to go to war against Achilles. And so I talk about that in the commentary. And I think it's a helpful lesson in remembering that many of the people that wrote these stories down had clerical training, were very widely read, and and there are not all stories that come from the Middle Ages that aren't Christian are kind of pure folkloric sort of, you know, grassroots creations. Some of them are very conscious political narratives.
Tell us about dragons under Oxford.
Yeah. Okay, so that was one of the harder stories to retell just because it's so wacky.
Yeah.
And that's found in the Mabinogion, a collection of Welsh language texts. Many of them are set in a kind of mythic ancient Britain. And this one is a kind of prequel to, so there's a story in Geoffrey of Monmouth about these two dragons that are locked inside a hill. And this story explains how they got into that hill in the first place. And it's during the reign of a king called Hluth or Lud, who we later told gave his name to Ludgate.
Okay.
So we can stay within the M25 bubble, even though we're talking there are three plagues tormenting the Britons. One is a fairy race that has such good hearing. They've invaded and they're everywhere, but they have such good hearing that you can't make any plans against them or to oust them without them hearing and working out how to defend themselves. The other plague is a scream so terrible and loud that it causes women to miscarry in the streets and livestock to die and blossoms to fall from the trees. And the third plague is that the royal stores of food keep disappearing, which means the king can't give any food. He can't eat any himself, and he also can't give any food to the poor, which is an important part of being a king, is that demonstration of largesse. And so the king Hluth goes and gets some advice from his brother Hlevelus, who is a king in Gaul, and they meet in the channel, and Hlevelus is this kind of wise man. He whispers the solutions to the plagues down the barrel of a horn. And it really looked, I mean, it's quite funny. So when I did the illustration for this one, I sort of showed one brother whispering into the narrow end of the horn while the other brother's listening carefully. And the editor said it, but it really looks like he's just whispering rude words down the, but you know, like brothers would do if they had a big horn, like met in the middle of the channel. But actually in the story, it says that all that Hluth can hear is kind of rude words. It actually says that, but actually it turns out there's a demon hiding in the horn and they expel it. And then he can hear what his brother's actually saying. So it's a super weird story. It's kind of really out there. But basically, the brother says that the second plague, the screaming, is the result of two dragons fighting. One is a native dragon, and it's red. And the other is a... actually, I'm not sure that they stipulate the colour in that particular text. But it's two dragons fighting. One is native, one's a foreigner. So it's about this theme of invasion. And the native dragon keeps screaming because it's being so badly hurt by the foreign invader. And he says, you'll catch these dragons by setting a trap in the center of the land, which for some reason is Oxford. And so Hluth makes this a very elaborate trap of a cauldron filled with mead and covered with a silk brocade cloth. And the dragons appear fighting in the air and fall down into the trap and drink all the mead and turn into pigs. You know, so it's a very strange story, but it's so interesting because it provides this prequel to why there are red and white dragons in a hill in Wales where Hluth takes them and hides them. And those red and white dragons become a really important symbol for the Britons and the Saxons. That's my attempt at abridging a very long and complicated narrative. But hopefully it's more clear in the book.
Well, it's good. It means people have to buy the book to find the whole story, to find out what it's all about. So you could not have done this book, could you, without going near King Arthur? Sure. Was that kind of like, oh God, here we go? Like, how do you tackle something that has been done to death over the years by every possible medium?
Well, I think the reason it's been done to death over the years is that there's just so much available to be inspired by in relation to King Arthur. And I was interested in the earlier sources about him, not so much the later medieval ones, which have things like The Lady in the Lake and more of the familiar Arthurian narratives. And also there was a lot of the French tradition that kind of gave rise to I think I'm not misrepresenting the material, but you know, Chrétien de Troyes is the first mention of Lancelot, I believe, and that adulterous affair. I wasn't so much interested in that. I was interested in the political, you know, my aim with choosing all the stories was, how did Britain become Britain? Where did the people come from? Yeah. And so Arthur was relevant because he was this legendary king, but also because he conquered other lands in the history. So he conquers Denmark, that kind of thing. He's one of the, from the perspective of a medieval historian, one of the ways in which Danish presence comes into Britain. You know, that's obviously, we hear about that through the Vikings.
Yeah.
And so I guess I had a different interest from most people who are writing about Arthur. I wanted to explain why certain places bear names relevant to his story. So one was that a hill in Radnorshire called Carngafaut, which is mentioned in a 9th century text, possibly by an author called Nennius, as the place where King Arthur's dog, Cabal, so that's where Carngafaut comes from, Cairn, the Cairn belonging to Cabal, he imprinted his paw in a stone and left a paw print. And so it says there's a stone on the top of this hill on a cairn, which if you take it away, so the stone bears the paw print of King Arthur's dog. If you take that stone away, the next day it will be back on the top of the cairn. And that hill still survives, obviously, and it's still got the name Carngafaut. And so I wanted to tell the story of the great hunt that led King Arthur's dog to run up to the top of that hill and imprint his paw in a stone. And what happened? What terrifying, dramatic thing happened that the kind of stones softened and took the form of this dog's paw?
Nuts.
It is nuts. It is really nuts.
About doing it through the eyes of a dog instead of through King Arthur.
Yeah, and there is a wonderful story also in the Mabinogion of King Arthur going on a great hunt around Wales. And I think that's a wonderful way that he manages to cover this huge landscape. Like, he goes from Ireland to St. David's and then up over the sort of mountains and then down to the Severn. And I think that it's very hard to express how a hero like Arthur, like, how big was he? Oh, well, he could, you know, uproot an oak tree or something. If you can say he can cover that landscape with those hills and those valleys and those rivers and those impassable forests, if he can do that just as part of a hunt, that's how big Arthur is. So yeah. I was really interested in how the landscape is a method of characterization.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant. It's just to look at something so well known as well and find a different way to tell it that sort of doesn't take into account like Ray Winston running around and Disney and what they've done to the story. It's really good. Mm-hmm. Let's do one more. I'm going to make people buy the book if they want to read about the Loch Ness Monster, because we don't want to give them everything. But let's do something Scottish. Who was the Angel of the Scots?
I love this story. And if anyone loves RuPaul, they'll love it too.
Yeah.
So basically, the legendary sort of founding king of Scotland is Kenneth MacAlpin, or he's sort of the first king of the Scots, according to legend. And he really wants to claim more territory than he currently possesses, or win more territory than he currently possesses. And most of it is being occupied by the Picts. And if people, you know, might recognize the Picts, they're a society that was completely wiped out. They were probably a Celtic peoples that occupied a lot of the north of Britain in the early Middle Ages. And the Picts have really annoyed him because they're meant to follow. So they've got an agreement with the Scots. They're meant to kind of only choose rulers from the female line because the Scots provided them with wives earlier on in history and this kind of thing. So anyway, they've stolen a dog, which has really irritated him. And they're also doing this thing with the Queen's, the royal line. So he says he's trying to convince his barons to make war against them, and they don't want to. And so he comes up with a very elaborate plan, which involves a extremely glittery costume made of fish skins.
Brilliant.
And that is the moment that, you know, the first king of Scotland sort of changes the fate of his dynasty.
That's amazing.
I'll leave it there and let people want more, I suppose. But
yes, absolutely. We'd be doing a disservice if we didn't talk before we go about the artwork in this book. It's yours, and you've mentioned it's lino cards. Why that medium, and how long did it all take?
the medium was really the moment, I suppose, when I, there's this, you know, I guess with any kind of world, because there is an element of world creation in this, and because it's fantastical, it's set in the mists of time. And I suddenly found it beautiful when I started illustrating it in lino cut with this very economical compositions, and this, you know, you can leave large areas of black with lino cut if you're using black ink. I use black ink. There was something about it that was so, there was so little information. And in the same way about the myths, it's like, you know, there are large areas of black, of dark matter in these myths as well. You know, that we have these fragments of text surviving, and that's part of what makes them beautiful. And not, you don't want to over describe, I think, when you retell them or illustrate them. So lino cut really lent itself to that. And so when I've, the other thing I've been really careful with in illustrating them is not historicizing. So I haven't used period specific costume on the characters. They're basically either naked or silhouetted or in quite fluffy fur collars. Mm. But that's a way of, I suppose, rendering them as archetypes. They are, the landscape is the thing that, that is recognizable, perhaps. And it's much more about seeing the humanity in the characters.
Yeah.
And the emotion in their, stories. And for instance, I started to see them in that kind of archetypal way, like especially the giants, when Gog Magog dies, the sort of the last giant of Albion, he came to me to symbolize a kind of extinction or a sort of domination of nature, because he's this just very possessive presence on the landscape, and the civilizing Trojans come in wanting to claim it. And so yeah, I think that's what lino, it sort of made it essential, and turned characters and moments into symbols for
How
me.
How long did they all take?
Well, I started doing them when I was finishing my PhD, so that was against the November 2018.
Yeah,
and I finished them. I really wanted to travel and see a lot of the places that I was writing about. Of course, COVID made that slightly more difficult. So I toured around in August when I was allowed to, and saw a whole load of the sites, and came back with fresh inspiration to finish off the lino cut. So that was, you know, I guess November 2019 to August 2020. And some of them were helped with, I recorded some songs as well to go with the lino cuts in the book that's on Spotify. It's an EP called Songs for Albion. And so it was all, I guess, the lino cuts, the prose and this music were all ways of like trying to home in on the emotion of the stories, because that's the thing that will really speak to us now.
It's brilliant. I hope 1,000 years from now someone finds it and that's like the text they use for the early.
I really hope so.
Early history
of Britain. It's taking in a long tradition of retelling medieval stories according to the present. So yeah.
Amy, this has been brilliant. The book Storyland is out now. It's on our bookshop online, and it is fabulous. It's such a good idea. Really good idea.
Thanks very much.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great